The recording that you're about to listen to is a talk from the City Bible Forum. We would appreciate you respecting our copyright by not making copies of this talk or altering the content in any way. We hope that you find the material beneficial. If you would like more information on the City Bible Forum, you can visit us on the web at citybibleforum.org.
Well, welcome, folks, once again to 2010 and the City Bible Forum. This is our first meeting for 2010, and it's great to have you back. I notice a few of our regulars and also a couple of visitors, so thank you for joining us. I work for the City Bible Forum, and I hope our name says it all, if you like, as to what we're about. We're about the city, particularly professional people, and giving them an opportunity to read the Bible. And we do it in a pub, so that people can come and hear a part of the Bible explained. Today we're looking at part of the Jewish Bible and a book called Jonah, and the first chapter of that. Our good friend David Old is speaking for us again, and it's great to have him back joining us. And what will happen today is that after you've grabbed some lunch and we've heard David speak, we'll have a bit of a question and answer time, and that's often a very interesting and productive part of our meeting. So we hope to, if you like, give you some information about what the Bible says, but also give you a chance to react to that. Before David gets up to speak, I'll just read this part of the Bible we're looking at today, just so you've got a chance to switch from business mode into reading this particular text and trying to understand it. And, so let me do that now. The word of the Lord came to Jonah, son of Amittai. I should point out that you'll find it in the little plastic sleeves. Just in front here, there's a couple of sheets with the text written on it. There's space on the back for notes. The word of the Lord came to Jonah, son of Amittai. Go to the great city of Nineveh and preach against it, because its wickedness has come up before me. But Jonah ran away from the Lord and headed for Tarshish. He went down to Joppa, where he found a ship bound for that port. After paying the fare, he went aboard and sailed for Tarshish, to flee from the Lord. Then the Lord sent up a great wind on the sea, and such a violent storm arose that the ship threatened to break up. All the sailors were afraid, and each cried out to his own God. And they threw the cargo into the sea to lighten the ship. But Jonah had gone below deck, where he lay down and fell into a deep sleep. The captain went to him and said, "How can you sleep? Get up and call on your God. Perhaps he will take notice of us, and we will not perish." Then the sailors said to each other, "Come, let us cast lots to find out who it is that is responsible for this calamity." They cast lots, and the lot fell on Jonah. So they asked him, "Tell us, who is responsible for making this trouble for us? What do you do? Where do you come from? What is your country? From what people are you?" He answered, "I'm a Hebrew, and I worship the Lord, the God of heaven, who made the sea and the land." This terrified them, and they asked, "What have you done?" They knew he was running away from the Lord, because he had already told them that. The sea was getting rougher and rougher, so they asked him, "What should we do to make the sea calm down for us?" "Pick me up," he said, "and throw me into the sea, and it will become calm. I know that it is my fault that this great storm has come upon you." Instead, the men did their best to row back to land, but they could not, for the sea grew even wilder than before. Then they cried to the Lord, "O Lord, please do not let us die for taking this man's life. Do not hold us accountable for killing an innocent man, for you, O Lord, have done as you pleased." Then they took Jonah and threw him overboard, and the raging sea grew calm. At this, the men greatly feared the Lord, and they offered a sacrifice to the Lord and made vows to him. But the Lord provided a great fish to swallow Jonah, and Jonah was inside the fish 3 days, 3 nights. Thank you, David.
Good afternoon, everybody. Good to see you all. Good to see some familiar faces, and great to see some people I don't recognise. Let's change that. Come and say hello to me afterwards. I wonder if you remember last year, we had the celebration of 50 years since the great Billy Graham crusade of 1959. And towards the end of last year, there were documentaries and pictures of Billy doing his preaching thing. And you couldn't get away from this one single verse. Hang on. Yes, thanks. On we go. There it is. Favorite Billy Graham's. And if you've hung around Christians for any small amount of time, someone's probably thrust this in front of you. Famous verse, John 3:16. From the lips of Jesus himself, "For God so loved the world that he gave his one and only Son, that whoever believes in him shall not perish, but have everlasting life. It says an audacious statement about what God is like. He loves the whole world, despite what we're like, and we're pretty useless, aren't we? He loves us, and he's done something about it. And the book of Jonah, you're probably wondering, what does the book of Jonah got to do with this? Well, the book of Jonah makes us ask, thanks, Ken, do you really believe this? Do you really believe those kind of grand, audacious claims about God? And we're going to ask ourselves this question as we dive in, no pun intended, to the story. Anybody? No. To the story of Jonah and his cruise ship adventure and the big fish. And quite importantly, more importantly, his very different mission to a city called Nineveh. Because as we look at Jonah, you actually find a man who is very uncomfortable with the idea that God does love the whole world. And because of that, he's going to kind of remind us a little bit about ourselves. Thanks, Ken. Now, Jonah was a prophet in the kingdom of Israel in the 8th century BC. And the kingdom, thanks again, was split into northern and southern kingdoms with Israel in the north and a country called Judah in the south. And Israel in the north was in a bit of a strange situation. They were led by a king called Joash who was not a nice piece of work. And Jonah's job, he was a prophet, that means he had a message from God. His job was to speak out against all the bad stuff that Joash was doing and to call the people of God back to God. Pretty standard prophet stuff if you read your Old Testament. And then God comes along and spoils it all for him by saying this. The word of the Lord came to Jonah, son of Amittai. Go to the great city of Nineveh and preach against it, because its wickedness has come up before me. Now, if you look at the map, you'll see that Nineveh, thanks again, is the capital city of Assyria, which was the great superpower to the north of Israel. And Israel and Assyria had been spoiling for a fight for quite a while. Well, that's not quite true. Assyria had been spoiling for a fight, and Israel had been sort of hiding behind the toilets trying to avoid them. And they were not on friendly terms. And God tells Jonah to go to Nineveh, the capital of Assyria, and preach against it. So he says, go to Nineveh, tell these people how wicked they are. Now, how many of you would fancy that job? Go to the capital city of the local superpower and tell them all that God is not very happy with them. So Jonah runs the other way. Well, we're not actually told yet why he runs, but he runs. By the time the book's over in the next 2 or 3 weeks, we're going to find out why he runs. But for now, all we do is we see him running away. And he runs, you can see it in your text in verse 3, to a place called Tarshish. Now, we're not quite sure where Tarshish is. Some have suggested it's a town on the southern Spanish coast, which would make sense because it's the opposite direction from where Jonah was went to go. Interestingly enough, the phrase ships of Tarshish is used somewhere else in the Bible to describe somewhere that's just a very long way away. So really, thanks, it's really just a clever play on words. Jonah is basically going as far away as he can get to the very end of the world. And so he sets sail. Which, of course, if you think about it for a minute, is just plain daft. Because Jonah thinks he can escape from God. Well, who would think that? Well, actually, you might, because in those days, there were some people who held the foolish notion that there were lots of gods, and each god was in charge of one particular place. So if you wanted to get away from the god from over there, you just run over there. But, of course, the true God, the true and living God of the Bible, is a lot bigger than that. And he knows exactly where Jonah is. He sends a massive storm and it threatens to capsize this large trading vessel. Now, the sailors, this time we flick to the sailors on the boat, and they haven't got a clue what's going on, but they think they know what they should do. Verse 5, if you read it, they each cry out to their own gods. So basically, they're just hedging their bets. Who knows who's in charge at this point? Out in the middle of the ocean, who knows where the land boundaries of each god extends? We don't know. Best just to spread our bets and cover them all. But it does them no good. So they start chucking cargo over the side as the boat rolls around in the storm. Meanwhile, Jonah is snoring away below deck. So the captain comes and wakes him up and urges him to pray to his God too. Now, at this point, Jonah must know what's going on, right? Here is the prophet of God on the run from God, and the captain of a sinking ship pleads with him, it's a lovely little line, says, please pray to your God in case it will make a difference. And then to pile on the pressure, the sailors devise a brilliant plan to work out what the problem is. They decide to draw lots. Now, I don't know how many sailors it takes to sail one of these boats. I'm guessing maybe 20. So there must be some accountants here. There's maybe 1 in 20, maybe a 5% chance, right, that Jonah's going to get picked. But you kind of know the odds are way short of that, don't you? Even before you finish verse 7, as you're reading it, you know who's going to pick the short straw. We know because we know that God is in charge, and Jonah is nothing short of crazy to think he can run away from God. As Jonah is waiting to pick the straws or whatever it is they do, dice or whatever, what was going on in his head? We're not told, but the result is a foregone conclusion. They cast lots, and the lot falls on Jonah. So then they interrogate him. You can read it, verse 8. They asked him, "Tell us, who is responsible for making all this trouble for us? What do you do? Where do you come from? What's your country? And from what people are you?" And Jonah finally fesses up. Look what he says. "I am a Hebrew. I worship the Lord, the God of heaven, who made the sea and the land." And if you're sensing just a small amount of irony building up in this story, that's because you'd be right. The sailors on the boat are all worshipping false gods, right? But at least they're serious about it. Even in their abject paganism, and the Bible is scathing about people who worship false gods. But even in their abject paganism, you cannot fault their devotion. They're doing it properly. Jonah, on the other hand, says, "I worship the true God, that is the Lord, the God of heaven, the God who made the sea and the land," except he just doesn't act like it at all, does he? He's run away from God. He's tried to escape him, not only by getting on a boat, but also by flying away to dreamland. But here's the point. How can you escape from the God who made the sea and the land? It's kind of almost like he's not taking it seriously. The sailors now take it seriously. Verse 10, this terrifies them, and they say, "What have you done?" They knew he was running away from the Lord because he'd already told them so. The sea at this point, you know, you can just imagine that the camera switching from the deck over the side of the ship. The sea is getting rougher and rougher. So they ask him, "What should we do to make the sea calm down for us?" And at this point, it is just pure comedy. When Jonah gets the message from God to go to Nineveh, he goes the other way. When the idolatrous pagan sailors hear about God's job for Jonah, they become what the Bible calls God-fearers. They take the true God very seriously. As the rage of the storm only increases, now they just want to know how to please God. So Jonah tells them. He says, "Throw me into the sea." Now, they don't want to do this, right? They have more respect for Jonah's life than Jonah himself seems to have. Instead, they get their oars out and they try and row back to shore. And what happens? The Bible says the storm gets wilder. And then these idolatrous pagans, they do what Jonah so far has not done. They cry out to God, verse 14. They cry out to the Lord, "Oh Lord, please do not let us die for taking this man's life. Do not hold us accountable for killing an innocent man. For you, O Lord, have done as you have pleased." They take him and they throw him overboard. And it's almost instantaneous. The sea just flat as a pancake, calms down. And so we're left here with the sailors safe on the boat and Jonah sinking like a stone to the bottom of the ocean. And look at the way that everything here has been turned upside down. You've got a bunch of pagans, all of which come from different religious backgrounds, now united together in service of the one true God, the God of Israel. So look at what it says in verse 16, if you just look again. "At this, the men," that's the sailors, "greatly feared the Lord, and they offered a sacrifice to the Lord and made vows to him." You read stuff in the Bible, right, and you don't kind of engage with it, but we need to understand how big a shift this is. At the start of the storm, remember, they're all worshipping their own gods. They're all crying out to their own gods. Hopefully one of them will help them. At the end of the storm, the language that's used of them is the same language that the Bible elsewhere uses of the most godly, devout, pious Israelites. They fear the Lord, which the scriptures famously tell us is the beginning of all wisdom. They offer sacrifices to the Lord, and they make vows. So basically, they get converted. And the most ironic of the three statements about them, at least ironic given the story we're reading, is that they make vows, they make promises to the Lord, in complete contrast to Jonah, who singularly failed to keep his promises to God. And now, as a consequence, he sinks like a millstone to the bottom of the ocean, whereupon God sends a huge fish to swallow him up. And I don't know about you, but if I was reading all that for the first time, and the problem is we never read these things for the first time, because so many of us hear these like in little Bible story books and stuff, and we can never kind of think seriously about what's going on. But if I was reading this for the first time, I'd be going, what's all that about then? And you kind of want to know, what do we make of all this? Is this just a great story waiting for Spielberg to come along and go, this will look really good on the screen? I'm not sure who they cast as Jonah. You suggest, make your suggestions in question time. But even here, you can actually start to draw, thanks, some clear conclusions. Here's the first one. First of all, you can immediately see that God has an interest in the whole world. You see that right at the start, as Jonah is told to go and preach to Nineveh. See, God is interested in not just what happens inside the borders of Israel, but also what happens in the wider world. He is a God that's always looking outwards, and so also his people should be looking outwards too. And Jonah, who was a prophet of God, would have known this, and so God's command should not have come as a surprise. And then you also see this global interest of God in the sailors. It's not a coincidence they end up being converted. The sovereign hand of God is all over it. Like the stark differences in their response with Jonah are evidence enough. They start off worshipping their own gods. By the end of it, they're united in worshipping the true God. Secondly, we see that there is no escaping God. I guess that can be a good thing or a bad thing, can't it? If you're on the run from God, then one thing you've got to take away from this is you can never run fast or far enough. God is always going to catch up with you. Jonah was, frankly, an idiot for thinking that he could run. It was stupidity. It was rank idiocy. So I want to say to you today, don't make the same mistake. But also, that same truth is actually a comfort to many people as well. There's nowhere in the world that God cannot reach you. So here's how a psalmist who wrote some songs in the Bible put it. Just take a moment to listen to these words. O Lord, you've searched me and you know me. You know when I sit and when I rise. You perceive my thoughts from afar. You discern my going out and my lying down. You're familiar with all my ways. Here he goes on a bit more later on. Where can I go from your spirit? Where can I flee from your presence? If I go up to the heavens, you are there. If I make my bed in the depths, you are there. If I rise on the wings of the dawn, if I settle on the far side of the sea, even there your hand will guide me, your right hand will hold me fast. If you're taking notes, that's Psalm 139, and there's plenty more there. And that is a real comfort, I hope, if you feel that God is ever distant. There is actually nowhere that God cannot reach us. There is no depth he cannot stretch to, no distance he can overcome. And maybe you're going through a rough time at the moment. I've just come back from Greenwich Hospital, where a member of our church family is, I think, 24 hours away from dying of cancer. And truths like this are a rich comfort to him and his wife and his family. Finally, one more observation for us to make, just from what we've seen today. Even this basic chapter of Jonah, this first chapter of Jonah, raises just core deep truths about God. First of all, we see a God who is the creator. Just pop it back, thanks. That's great. We see a God who is the creator of all things. Jonah calls him the maker of the sea and the dry land. This is the true God. The Bible's presentation of God is not just a little parochial God, not a little God in one little place. This is the God who made everything and is in charge of everything. You also see a very key theme in the Bible hinted at here as well, which we'll see come to more fruition later on. And we see that God is, and this is not politically correct, but we're going to do it anyway, God is angry at what the Bible calls sin, the way that each and every one of us turn away from God. He's so angry at sin that he actually wants to send Jonah to speak against the sin in Nineveh. And we'll see over the next 2 weeks that this proclamation in the book of Jonah against sin is actually heavily tied up with forgiveness. You can't quite see that yet, but we're going to see it in a while over the next few weeks. But just see that it's there. And one more thing. Let me draw to your attention again the clear change in the lives of the sailors. When someone becomes a Christian, when someone signs up to follow the true and living God and his King Jesus, that is not like signing up to the footy or taking your kids to the nippers. That is a radical and complete change in who you are. The Bible is consistently saying if God is the God of the universe, if he is the one that made the land and the sea and all things in it, then to follow him must mean a complete change of who you are. We see that in the lives of the sailors, and perhaps there is a possibility we may see that in the city of Nineveh in weeks to come. We'll see as we carry on afterwards, but for now, we're done. Now, questions. Does anybody have any questions? I've got a question. How to make this work? This worked perfectly for 3 weeks, and then you touched my computer. You want to go on?
Yep.
I just forgot to explain, just for people who are visiting maybe the first time, if you have a question, there's a couple of ways you can ask it. One, of course, is to call it out, but you need a big voice. It's a very tall ceiling. Another option would be to write on one of the sheets at on the back of the pack that we gave you. And if you wave that, I'll make sure it gets to David. Okay? Thanks.
You got one, Ken. Are you just trying to cause trouble? What type of literature is it? There's actually a debate amongst scholars of the Bible as to what's going on in the book of Jonah. So there are two schools of thought. One is that it's an actual literal account of things that have actually historically happened. And the other is there's a stylized account meant to impart a truth about God, but didn't actually historically happen. Some people might use the word myth. I don't think they mean it in a derogatory way. I think they genuinely say there's a truth about God here, which we're going to discover, and it's kind of parceled in a story, a bit like Aesop's fables or some of the fairy tales that I read to my kids. I reckon probably the first. Let me tell you why I reckon the first. I reckon the first because Jesus in the Gospels makes a number of references to Jonah and seems to refer to him like a real historical event. And in one place in particular, I think it's Matthew 12, but I'll check afterwards for you. He talks about a lady called the Queen of Sheba, who you may have heard of, who comes to visit Solomon. And then he talks about Jonah almost in the same breath. And the Queen of Sheba, we're pretty sure, was a historical figure. And so there's just no reason to think he shifts his understanding as he does that. So that's the debate. Look, if you're not convinced historically that these things actually happened, I guess I want to go, okay then, let's make sure we understand what's being taught by it. But I'm also not convinced the Bible actually works that way. The Bible actually says you can know things for sure about God because he actually has acted in certain ways. It's a bit like me saying, I know that my wife loves me because she actually stood up and made some vows, and then every day she behaves in certain ways, unless I'm being a complete prat, and so forth. I could say, look, I know she loves me in theory, and I've got some nice stories I made up about it. It just doesn't have the same authenticity, I think. But, you know, there's schools of opinion, and people who I've got a lot of respect for have mixed opinions on this. I see someone sitting their hand up at the back. Brave man. So was Jesus in his... So the Bible's claim is that Jesus is the second person of the Godhead, the second person of the Trinity, always eternally pre-existent, and yet took on a human body, not just sort of fitted it on for a while, actually became human as well as being God. So the question there, a great question is, as we think about thinking back to Jesus quoting about Jonah and stuff, is was he simply expressing the thought world of his contemporaries? Or does he have some superhuman, let's call it almost divine, knowledge? I want to go for the latter. Let me just give you a couple of reasons why. First of all, he displays superhuman ability in every other area. So, for example, the church I'm working at in Neutral Bay, we're currently preaching through Mark's gospel, Mark's account of the life of Jesus. And very early on, you see Jesus doing stuff like knowing in his heart what's going on in people's hearts. So he's able to tell immediately what you're thinking. Just from across the room and that kind of thing. The other reason I want to go, yes, he knows, is because Jesus speaks about himself as though he is that guy that has been around forever. So famously, I think particularly you see this in John's gospel more than anywhere else, Jesus makes some dramatic claims about his history. And at the end of chapter 8, there's a profound moment where he's stouching off against some very religious Jews, and they're telling him he's nuts. And he's going, no, I'm not nuts, but you're the children of the devil, because he's always polite like that. They start to mention Abraham to him, and Abraham's like a really big figure in the history of Israel, and he was 2,000 years prior to Jesus. And Jesus says this remarkable thing. He says, Abraham was excited about seeing the day that I was going to be around, and he did see it, and he was very excited about it. The words he actually uses are, Abraham rejoiced to see my day, he saw it, and he was glad. So basically says, look, Abraham met me, And they say to him, are you out of your mind? You know, you're not yet 50 years old, and you claim to have met Abraham, which is, of course, not what he's claiming. He actually claimed that Abraham met him. It's a different thing. And Jesus responds to that, and he says, before Abraham was, I am. Which sounds like really bad grammar, but actually it's a really great statement, because I am is the name of God. So Jesus walks around and he says, no, I was there. I was walking around. In another form, and that's a time for another. That would make a great series of talks, wouldn't it? You and I can chat about that afterwards. But no, Jesus gives every indication of being aware of his pre-existence and of being supernaturally aware of those things. And in terms of him being enculturated, he is a man who walks around and radically breaks all the rules of his culture. So I want to go in each and every way, sensitive to his culture, but so much more. Supercultural might be a way to put it. Thanks. Great question. Good question. Anybody else want to ask a question and have another sermon preached at them? No, I think we're done. Well, look, I'm going to grab some pizza afterwards. So if you want to come and chat to me afterwards, that would be great.
Thanks for joining us. If there's any food left, please help us by finishing it off. And you're more than welcome to stay and chat if you can. Thank you.
The recording that you have just listened to is from the City Bible Forum. For more information about City Bible Forum events in your city, or to order other talks, please visit citybibleforum.org.